Okay, well, I was going to start. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the panel on collaboration in international communities. My name is Ana Boa Ventura. I'll be moderating this panel. I'm Portuguese and a doctoral candidate at University of Texas here in Austin. Also the Associate Director for Digital Media for a new five-year program between my country and this university, University of Texas. So let me tell you how we're going to run this panel. I'm going to introduce really briefly the topics we'll cover, and then we'll hear from each speaker for 5 to 7 minutes, and I'll be really strict about timing here. And then I'll have two questions for them, and they've heard one of them, but I haven't heard the second one. So hopefully the objective of that second question is that they it will trigger a more spontaneous response from them and hopefully trigger a heated debate on this side that we can then pass on to you and hopefully learn from your own experiences and practices in this field. We'll hear from me, Aaron Marcus on cultural models. We'll hear from Prentice Riddle on the UT Portugal partnership and potential cultural markers in Second Life. We hear from Steve Howard on the 50 by 15 initiative. And last but not least, from Tim Langdell, again on cultural models, sort of to close the circle, but this time on game design specifically. So why did I think of this, proposing this topic to South by Southwest, and why did I have I wanted exactly these four people with me here today? And before I say that, let me tell you why the strange title of this panel, the first part is Red Rum in the Room Org, Collaboration in International Communities. Well, it's a mixed reference to both Murders in the Room Org, a story written by Edgar Allan Poe that's really about language, and To Shining with Jack Nicholson. So both allusions deal really with language, right? This topic is very dear to me because obviously, I am a Portuguese living abroad on one hand, but then on the other hand, I've had several experiences, work-related experiences that prove to me that culture is fundamental in the way we see and we design everything. And particularly, and I guess because I have somebody from Brazil here, I could say one of the most interesting experiences was with SEBRAE, a governmental agency in Brazil that I did consulting work for. And we work on a portal for small entrepreneurs in Brazil. And I was struck by the fact that I realized that although we share the same language, we don't share the same culture, we have real important differences in the way, in the things that we look for in portals and the tools that we want for communication. So another interesting experience was here in Austin. I was fortunate enough to have worked with an amazing woman, Anne Beamish, who is now back at MIT, but she taught at University of Texas briefly. And I worked with her on a community of architects and designers that in the beginning, the community was only about architecture in the Arab world, Muslim architecture. And then it just grew, and now it includes over 170 countries. So many lessons learned there, too. And I guess the one I highlight here today has to do with Portugal. We just had our smoking ban since January 1st this year. And so I was commissioned by the Ministry of Health in Portugal to develop a portal for smoking cessation and other topics in public health, such as breastfeeding, etc. And the budget was tight, which is very Portuguese, but also a pretty universal when we get to health matters, right? So I had to work with stock photography. And I was shocked when I realized that, things like istockphoto.com, it's really difficult, it was very difficult for me to get photos of women that remotely looked like Portuguese women. So, you know, I had to do silly things like writing on the search field, you know, Hispanic women, Latinas, and things like that, because to avoid the blonde, white-skinned, very tall women that are not at all the Mediterranean type. And by the same token, when I would write things like Portugal, Portuguese, keywords like this, I would get these images of fish markets and fruit markets in Portugal. And I don't want to go as far as to say these are stereotypes, but they definitely refer to a certain bucolic image that we all have from countries, right? And a certain nostalgia that we associate, you know. I can imagine why if a professional amateur photographer contributing to things like iStockphoto.com would go to Portugal and go to these fish markets and take this type of photo. So in terms of my work, I couldn't find a single photo that would represent white collar working class in Portugal. So that was pretty disappointing. So no further ado. Here is Aaron Marcus. He's president of Aaron Marcus and Associates, a company based in Berkeley. I'm very, very happy that he could make it to Austin. Aaron has clients all over the world. While we were preparing for this panel, you know, I was emailing back and forth with Aaron, and he was in Japan, and then he was in Moscow, and he was in Kiev. And so, anyway, here's Aaron. Please.
Hello. Can you hear me? Okay. How many of you are English as second language people? I want to apologize to you because normally, as I did in Japan, Russia, and the Ukraine, I would speak much more slowly, but I only have 5 minutes. I'll have to speak a little more quickly. I want to say a few things about culture, collaboration, communication, and communities. First of all, about our company. I'm the first graphic designer to work with computer graphics back in 67. I started my firm in 1982 to design user interfaces and information visualization for applications, websites, mobile platforms, you name it, and we've probably done it. Most of the time we're thinking about usability, usefulness, and appeal. We helped to design the first version of AOL, Travelocity, and Orbitz. We recently have just finished working with eBay for a year and a half, not on the front end, but the back end, actually, to keep their network up. We've been interested in cross-cultural communication. I noticed a proposal of ours from 1984 proposing cultural differences in Federal Express's user interface design. We designed the user interface for the Getty Museum in Los Angeles to appeal to a more diverse community of people. We worked on the user interface for Sabre, used by one-third of the world's travel agents, and actually created multicultural, multiracial imagery for that site, as Anna was talking about trying to find. We worked on Motorola's in-car vehicle navigation system and Samsung and other mobile device products and services. Somewhat recently, we helped to design and then did usability studies for HP's virtual meeting room called Halo, which is rather fancy, rather amazing, and costs $500,000 a piece, so it's not on everyone's shopping list. I'm the editor of User Experience, a magazine of the Usability Professionals Association, and have written for 5 years a column in Interactions, which is a leading user interface design magazine. As we know from creating products and services for many different countries and cultures, people are different around the world. You have to change the metaphors, mental models, I'm slowing down for this, navigation, interaction, and appearance to match the characteristics of the user communities that you're trying to communicate to. That means the not only the language change, but also specific graphics, layouts, behavior of the system, and assumptions about how people behave. Currently, content management systems on the web can deal with multiple languages, but not necessarily with multiple cultures. And we're going to need to do more thinking about this in the future as we think about products and services being successful around the world. There are people who have studied culture for centuries, but also since 1939, in books about culture patterns. Gert Hofstede is one of the well-known analysts. He has five dimensions of culture. They're debated. Some people criticize them, think them too stereotyped and the data too old. There are other people, but people are searching out for ways to understand the patterns of how people work and play and study. We did our own study of 9 different theories of culture, came up with 29 different dimensions of culture. We've published an article about this, which we can send you if you're interested. We surveyed about 60 experts around the world to come up with the best dimensions for analyzing culture. Context, high or low, whether the technology is very advanced or not, and they have a positive view, uncertainty avoidance, which is high or low in different cultures, time perception about whether people think about the future, the present, or the past, and are long-term or short-term time-oriented, and authority conception, which is somewhat like Hofstede's power distance dimension. If you're thinking about Web 2.0, my goodness, if you're thinking about social networks and communities, that is reeking with people differences in a country or around the world. We better start thinking about what makes sense. In Web 2.0 developments, people are thinking about co-creation, connecting, and customizing all the time. Think about it in all of the companies that you know about, think about, and play with. These companies are going to have to think much more, as well as the many startups serving them, about how culture can be incorporated into Web 2.0 developments in order to optimize that customer experience or user experience. From that, we may be able to get a database created which will help when you're designing to be able to know what is the right thing to do, at least as a first version of things, which professional designers would then tweak and tune as necessary. There's a lot to be researched, a lot to be done. It's quite exciting. We're involved with some of these topics and activities now. And we will definitely, I believe, see culture-centered design make considerable progress. It has to, or these sites are just not going to work. If you're interested, I have another hat here. Throw a business card or your email address into it, and I promise to send you a list of about 100 publications and URLs about topics of culture that we've been studying for many years. Thank you very much. Did I make it under 5?
You did.
Good.
Thank you so much, Aaron. We decided to have all the presentations in one laptop, so everybody will be shifting chairs here. And on to our next presenter, and while we get his presentation up, I am very, very happy to have Prentice Riddle as a colleague in the UT Portugal partnership. Prentice works with the CoLab, which is really the overarching structure that coordinates the several areas of this partnership between Portugal and University of Texas. And I was very, very happy when I first met Prentice in the first meeting where we were. Notice I was the only Portuguese in the room. Everybody else was American, including Prentice. And he said, okay, so wait a minute, isn't this a UT Portugal program? So how come we don't have any content on the web in Portuguese? And from that point on, you know, I knew that we were on the same wavelength. And it's been great working with Prentice, who is also a resident of Second Life, and who would like to share with you here today some of his observations, many of them empirical, about our behaviors that may be cultural or not in Second Life. So here's Prentice.
Well, I'm afraid I did a bait and switch on you, Anna, because I finally decided I hadn't logged enough hours in World to really talk about Second Life,
okay.
But I would love to speculate about it later if people want to. Instead, I wanted to address the cultural models topic on the modest title of Cultural Models Considered Harmful. Basically, I figured my role here would be to make some trouble and some drama on the platform, as if we didn't have enough life on the platform already. So I'm going to set up a straw man, knock him around a little bit, and then my co-panelists can tell me why I'm full of it. So my straw man has a face. We've already heard the name Gert Hofstede. I really like this book. It's full of bubble plots and things that geeks would love. It's full of, it's kind of mystical in a way. It's fascinating the way Jung is fascinating, or the Tarot, I've got some links in the PowerPoint that I'm going to put up that you can pursue, or you can put your card in the hat, and there'll be better links, I'm sure. We already heard about the five dimensions of culture, so I won't even touch on that again. But the biggest problem I see with cultural models, especially national cultural models, which is what one most often hears about, is a granularity problem, a unit of analysis problem. The blobs on the map are too big, and the lines between the blobs are drawn in the wrong places. So they lump together things that don't go together, and they divide things that do go together. It's a pretty obvious problem, and the people who work on it acknowledge that. But to me, it means that starting with nationality as the unit of analysis is just completely the wrong place to begin. It also reminds me of the first law of information architecture, which we've known about since the Gopher days, which is don't pattern your IA after the org chart. And national boundaries are just the org chart. And passports are just the TPS reports of the organization. Again, the wrong place to start. So does that mean I don't believe in culture or believe in paying attention to culture? No. I am not following the Colbertian theory. It's not that I don't see culture. The alternative I would call, for lack of a better name, the sixth sense theory, which is I see subcultures. And I chose a horror movie for a reason, because subcultures are very scary. They're ephemeral. They float around. You can't really put your finger on them or pin them down. Some people don't see them at all, or everybody sees them in a different way. And what's more, they're dangerous, because most of us have heard it's a small world after all enough times that we're not going to say that people from country X are all like country Y, but we still all harbor beliefs either that we're conscious of or unconscious of about subcultures. That's where the real prejudices lurk. Not to mention class. I'm really fascinated with the debate that's finally emerging, partly because of Dana Boyd's piece last summer about the propagation of Facebook through one set of social classes in the United States and MySpace through another. People are starting to look at this, and there are those who say we talk about class even less in this society than race and some of our other hot-button topics. Okay, back to cultural models. Another problem with them is that cultural models are really hard to operationalize. Anna and I have been working on this Portugal project and trying to set up some modest tools so that we can collaborate across a big ocean. And we've been playing with blogs and wikis. Anna comes up with interesting observations about Portuguese culture. But then we get into, does it really mean that we should use a blog instead of a wiki because the Portuguese national character is such and such? Even more, does it mean that the sidebars should be on the left or the right, or the colors should be such and such, or what fonts go with Portuguese culture? Of course, these models don't tell us these things. Furthermore, looking at cultural models may blind you to more important ground truth related to place than culture, like basic access. Do you have electricity, hardware, bandwidth, et cetera? We're going to hear more about that. And usability. We found to our embarrassment that when people weren't using our wiki, it wasn't necessarily because Portuguese culture is inimical to wikis. It was because we had it on an intranet where theoretically anyone could get access, but the usability of the sign-up was insane, and it was really an intra-UT versus outside world problem. So, again, culture is not the right place to start. Basically, the way I look at it is that the hardest part of collaboration and setting up community online is the buy-in. It's the startup. It's the getting people to invest their time on something that's not a sure thing. And buy-in is micro. It's not macro. It has to do with the value proposition for an individual in a specific context. And those specific contexts are much narrower than big national cultures. As anybody who's, you know, worked in the heavy-duty marketing world, let's say, knows, or the e-commerce world, they get very micro in their models. So what's left, unfortunately, I have a very pessimistic answer, and that's the usual best practices. Talk to your users, go to where your users are and observe what they do, involve your users in participating in the design, be agile so you can afford to iterate. That's the hard part and the hard solution to all the problems we look at, not just the cultural ones. Oh, and I promised a gratuitous lolcat, so there it is.
Thank you, Prentice. A lot of great material here for discussion afterwards. And on to our next speaker. It is my great pleasure to introduce Steve Howard, Senior Manager for the 50 by 15 Initiative, AMD, headquarters here in Austin. Steve is probably, well, although we have been talking about real communities to an extent, but Steve is probably going to talk really about very real communities in Kenya, in Brazil, in Nigeria, and in all these wonderful countries that they have been working with. And with some concepts that, as far as I'm concerned, are pretty revolutionary as far as social inclusion programs that have to deal with digital media. Okay, there's a concept that I hope Steve will talk to us about, has to do with ecosystems that should exist locally in these communities that I think is very unique. So here's Steve.
Great. Thank you, Anna, and good afternoon, everybody. Appreciate you taking the time to be here. I'm going to go very quickly because there's a video that I wanted to show you, and I can't show you the whole thing because it's about 7 minutes long, and out of respect to my panelists, I want to stay within the five-minute allocation. So without further ado, I do represent an initiative called 50 by 15, which is an initiative started by AMD to connect half of the world's people to the Internet by 2015. Hence, 50 by 15. And where we are today, it was right at about 20% of the world's people have reliable internet access. And so what we want to do is ensure that we're putting the various ecosystems in place, as Anna mentioned, to give people the reliable access, the affordable access, and to do so in what's called a geocentric way, in the sense that we're taking local cultures into account and respecting them as we go in and offer internet access throughout the world. So many companies, very well-meaning companies throughout history have, or I guess I should say throughout history of technology, have gone to the developing world and brought a pallet full of computers and laptops and said, "You're connected. Here's your PC. Welcome to the internet age." But as soon as they climb back on the plane, fly back over the ocean, that's when the problems begin to occur. Because as you all well know, computing technology today requires a support infrastructure to ensure that it remains sustainable and viable for the long term. So there was a study commissioned by the World Economic Forum to find out why is it that well-meaning digital inclusion activities so often fail. And in that study, they were able to come up with the six key elements you see at the bottom of the screen there. And then there's a seventh element that through our travels and through our experience, we've been able to add to the mix, and that is the need for reliable structures in addition to the components you see on the bottom. So very quickly, we'll step through each one. And by the way, each one of the images you see here were taken by us during our journeys throughout the world. This is a health clinic in Rwanda, and what you see on the poles there are solar panels that provide power to this health clinic. So obviously power and innovative power is a key need because most places in the developing world do not have a reliable power grid. Some will even argue that our own country lacks a reliable power grid, as we all well know when the summer comes around and the air conditioning cuts out. Financing is absolutely critical. This is a shot taken in Nairobi of, I guess, what could be considered a Best Buy that is available to the folks there. And you see the computers just to the left of the gentleman in the red hat. That's what they have. And the ability for people to purchase and own computing equipment depends upon the access to microfinancing and easy access to credit, and credit on a smaller term. So a few dollars a week that enables them to have a loan for a total of $200 is absolutely essential. Content. You know, we have here an example also taken in Kenya of an internet cyber cafe tucked among the shanty town there in Nairobi. And you have to think about when we're talking Web 2.0 and all the great, cool, advanced things that we're able to do using dual core processors and just a ton of memory and all the tools we have. Think about the people that are trying to access the internet for the first time. It can be argued that an emphasis still needs to be placed on Web 0.2 because these folks may be using a refurbished machine. They may be using a thin client, which doesn't have the computing power necessary to venture through Second Life in a meaningful manner. So again, the encouragement is that we want to have initiatives and companies focused on creating basic computing capability in addition to the advanced computing computing capability we're discussing today. In addition, there's a need for expertise, meaning we want to ensure that the people and the talent that it takes to get people on the internet is available. And this expertise not only includes what you see here, which is the OldNet project in Brazil. I'm honored to have my colleague here, Walter Segal, in the front row, who came up from Sao Paulo, not just for this, but he happened to be in town. And Walter is our local partner manager that helped put this into implementation. This uses tech-savvy youth to train the senior citizens of Sao Paulo on not only the benefits of computing access, but also how to use the internet in a meaningful way. Connectivity. This is a shot taken in Uganda and emphasizes the need to not only have a reliable connectivity method, but also to ensure that the connectivity is sustainable for the long term. Pay attention to that picture and you'll see something wrong. The satellite dish is pointing to the ground. So this is another good example of how a very well-meaning organization came in, put a satellite dish in place, and then after they left, who knows what happened? Either a kid played on it or the wind blew it, but it's no longer usable. But the people there know it's important. And so they were so proud to show us this link to the world. Even though it wasn't working, they said, see, we have the capability. It's up to us to ensure that the local knowledge is in place that these people actually can access the information on a long-term basis. This is an abandoned health clinic in Nepal. This is the seventh element I mentioned earlier, which is the need to ensure that there is reliable structures that can house computing equipment once it's there. The other six parts of the ecosystem absolutely play a critical role, but if you put all that technology into a structure that's not also sustainable for the long term, then you're exposing it to the elements. And that in turn leads to a very quick death for a well-meaning program. So I, as is the case, I started talking too much and I probably don't have enough time for the video. So if there's time afterward, I'll be happy to show it to you. Last element I wanted to mention are the devices. And most of you have probably heard of the One Laptop Per Child program. If you look very closely in the lower part of the image, you'll see the children looking at one of the EXO laptop devices. I have one of them with me here. I'm happy to set it on the table and turn it on at the end of the panel. So please come on up, try it out, and I'm happy to answer any questions you have about it. But a very important point on OLPC, because it is controversial, this is an example of a device that uses innovation to get people connected to the internet, but it's not the only device. It's very important to remember that it's going to take many types of technology to connect half the world to the internet by 2015, including laptops, standard PCs, mobile handsets, and other innovations that are yet to come. The key thing about this program is it does so in a cost-efficient manner and does so using innovations that I'll be happy to tell you about at the end of the panel. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Steve. I think that maybe at the end, if there's time, we could see the video. And please do set up the laptop so that people can play with it. You probably have seen green, really cute, looks like little ears, the idea of the mesh network that Steve probably will tell us a little bit more about. And I'd like now to introduce Tim Langdell, who is a professor at the School of Media and Communications at the National University, headquarters in San Diego, although Tim is head of the game design area, and that one is based in L.A., as it should be, right? And I guess Tim and I met last year, maybe, 1 year and a half ago.
Couple of years ago, yeah.
During the organization of a conference on virtual communities and civic entrepreneurship. Yes. So here's Tim.
Okay. Well, here's a different take on it. By the way, I like the use of the one laptop foot as a sunshade and an encouragement for learning better posture. That's excellent multi-use of technology. When I was thinking about the whole concept of collaboration and video games, it suddenly struck me that over the past couple of years in particular, the international nature of computer games and video games has just become ever more apparent. There are at least three major ways in which those of us in the game industry are, you know, having to think harder and harder about international collaboration. First, in the design of games, we have to, anyone that just looks at one market for your game is missing a huge section of the international available market for game distribution. Trying to design a single game that will play well, that will be, you know, right for every culture, every background, let alone all the language issues that you face when you design a game. Horrendous hurdles, really, that we face in trying to figure out how to create games that will play on a very wide scale. Then we've got the fact that we're creating the games across international boundaries as well. You've got development teams around the world that are having to work together, not just purely because of the localization factors, but also because of the growth of offshore development, of having animation done around the world, programming done around the world, putting all the pieces together and making it all work. And then it occurs to me that one of the major areas that has really seen a phenomenal growth in the past couple of years is the fact that we're actually all playing together around the world in the games as well. And one of the most notable examples I came across, actually in the six, two of these things, both the playing together and the design element in the game World of Warcraft. Not a game that I've been involved in. By the way, my games company was founded in 1979. We've been around, therefore, since about the beginning, done about 200 games. The whole advent of international social gaming is to me just incredibly exciting. I love the fact that when I go onto World of Warcraft, the game encourages team play, playing in groups, so you're likely to be in a group of 5, 10, 25, and there's an anonymity to it because you're playing characters, avatars, I'll show you in a moment, and it's not immediately obvious who you're playing with, what time zone they're in, what language, what their first language is, or anything like that. And yet you're all working together to collaborate to achieve a common goal, sometimes with hilarious consequences. But I wanted to just point out a sort of almost cultural imperialism type of example. Video games, I think, have this push and pull effect on world culture. That is, to some degree, video game culture is actually imposed on other cultures. In other words, just as we've put the QWERTY keyboard curse on everyone on the planet, and there was an ASCII and so forth, all these horrible things. Speaking as a Brit, American English has been put upon the world through computers as well. You could have got the English right. No, just kidding. But here's a fun example of how almost cultural assumptions, not just about the culture of the target audience, but a cultural assumption about what type of games another culture would like, and how it can go fundamentally wrong. Those who know World of Warcraft, bear with me. Those who don't, it's a fantasy world. It's a fabulous 3D world in which you're encouraged to be one of two factions, either Alliance or Horde. Alliance are all the, you could think of them as the good guys. So the cute little gnomes, the dwarves who've got Scottish accents. It's good fun. Humans, of course, all very pretty. And even the night elves are very elegant. And the other side of this is the Horde. And they're kind of cool to play because they're orcs and taurens and undead and trolls. And basically the dynamic of the game relies upon the fact that people will pretty much 50-50 pick to be either Horde or Alliance. And they're going to fight against each other and be in competition. And this was launched to phenomenal success here in America about 4 years ago now, I think. Launched a phenomenal success in Europe. And then Blizzard, the makers of the game, were looking to the launch in the Far East, in particular in Korea, the number one place on the planet where people play online games, massively multiplayer online games. They knew this was going to be a phenomenal hit there. They had to get it right for that market. They launched it and it went thud. It was, something went wrong here. And so they did a little bit of market research after launching the game. And discovered that Korean game players don't like playing ugly-looking characters. So they had to go back and redesign the game for everyone on the entire planet to satisfy an Asian market. So they created pretty-looking bad guys, the Night Elves, and not-so-good-looking good guys for the Alliance, the Hooves and so forth. You can see it a little bit more clearly there. And it literally took them by surprise that they had to... Whoops. How do you get back on this? That way. And it took them by surprise that they had to... it was a complete shock to them that they would have to redesign it in this way. So really just want to put that out there as another way in which we have to get another dimension to the whole, cultural considerations. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. So, when you get one of these, you sort of
Well, thank you, Tim, and thank you, everybody. Well, now for that question that I've emailed the group of panelists before, and we exchanged some emails between us and exchanged some ideas. Actually, the question and some of the answers are in the official blog for South by Southwest, but I'm going to assume you haven't seen it. And basically, the question is, how have you, in your practice, in your research, and even in your teaching, dealt with cultural models, or if you deal with cultural models at all, and while at the same time avoiding the trap, the easy trap of falling into cultural stereotypes. So, and you don't all need to answer this, but who would like to go first? You can use your mics. And
we have done a number of studies of corporate B2B and B2C websites, about 12 of them, and published a 60-page report in Visible Language showing the patterns that supposedly uniform cross international corporate websites are supposed to follow do differ, and the differences that can be observed are in keeping with the predictions of culture models, in this case Hofstede's, but it didn't necessarily have to be that one. I think we could have used other dimensions and found other patterns. So we're certainly observing these differences. As for practical work, we have evaluated a major credit card company's global website, a certain portion of that, tested it with 11 different countries in order to find usability problems and culture problems, in effect trying to get at both the issues I think that Prentice was talking about earlier. And we did find usability problems. We also found imagery in the site that not only caused confusion but actually caused customers to get angry. And that's not exactly what most credit card companies or corporate people would like to have their customers feeling when they see the imagery on the website. So we have found practical ways to apply this in terms of designing. We did try in Saber to develop different racial appearances for the customer or the user in order to make the users be able to self-identify better, just as you were looking for particular Portuguese faces and people in, I forget what you were creating,
a collaborative
website. Yeah. So that those are some examples.
Thank you. Thank you, Aaron. Anybody else on this one?
Sure, I'll answer this. Again, I mentioned that one of the key premises to our initiative is to be very geosensitive when we introduce internet access, especially in parts of the world that either had a very limited experience with computing technology or none at all. And a good example is we went to a small village called Santa Teresa, which is in Mexico, and it's literally on top of a mountain and accessible only by horseback. And they don't have any modern conveniences that we're used to, such as electricity, running water, permanent structures, and so forth. And we were very hesitant to go there and explain who we are and what we're proposing to do for fear that they would say, we've survived this long without it. We don't want it. It's, you know, and more of a fear-based reaction. And we were quite surprised when not only had they heard of the internet, but were very hungry for it for two reasons. One, they specialize in designing very colorful tapestries, bags, dresses, native dress, and they saw a market opportunity beyond their village. They wanted e-commerce access so that they could improve the cash flow coming in and out of the village so that they can then turn around and improve their infrastructure and improve their lives. Interesting fact number two is they speak a language unique to their village. And they're very concerned that as the young people of the village left in order to find employment and a better lifestyle elsewhere, that that language would eventually die. They saw the internet as not a way of bringing a different culture in, but of preserving theirs and educating people outside of their village on their local language and on how they live their lifestyle. So it was very much a dichotomy in terms of what we expected and what truly was the reaction once we got there.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve. I think I'm going to the next question. This is going to be an impromptu question, so they don't know what I'm going to ask, and which is, when we say that we design global, do we mean that we're designing American, more exactly North American?
Yeah, I think that's definitely been one of the issues in the games industry, that the two major design cultures, the Japanese design culture and the American design culture, have tend to dominate the world market. And oftentimes it's not really been a matter of a huge amount of consideration in the, at the design stage when actually, you know, working out where it's going to play. I'm reminded of, there's a tremendous amount of work needs to be done in the games industry. When I hear the sort of granularity of some of the responses and thinking of what the work, the research that's been done into designing websites and so forth, and thinking that the game industry is at a infant level. I know that when we produced some of our first games, even though we marketed them on a worldwide basis, they were primarily in the English language. And what we discovered with great intrigue was that the software pirates around the world would hack into our game, replace the English language text with local text, and replace some graphics that didn't quite work in their culture with their own graphics. And we get it back and go, well, we're really annoyed you did this, but wow, that's cool. So maybe this is an iterative process that we could actually use the piracy system to help us design. Being contrarian.
Thank you, Tim. Prentice, do you want to?
Sure. Well, I think the answer is obviously yes and obviously no. I think it's mostly yes, but I think also, you know, the technologies we're talking about are very grassroots and bottom up in their potential. And as people come online everywhere, they find that they turn them to their own uses. At the same time, we are producing massive quantities of new content and using a lot of power to market it and shove it down people's throats in the same old top-down models as before. So, I think, like everything else, it's like the attacks on MySpace or the support of MySpace. Everything has got its dark side and its light side, and both of them are in full play all the time.
Thank you. Aaron, please.
I have a couple of quick anecdotes that, people who have been studying culture know that Asians cultures are much more accepting of cuteness and cartoon imagery. And in my mind, it's not a surprise that you would see that kind of reaction to games imagery, because if you walk up and down Tokyo streets, you won't see ugly cartoons. You'll see very pretty, cute cartoons. The fact that some game makers are in a coma about this is similar to our credit card company client saying, I can't imagine why a picture of some white man playing golf would be offensive to someone over in other countries, when in fact they were reacting to the race, the gender, and the sport. Why wasn't it soccer, for example? So there are people in place who are producing these things who need to be educated about some of these differences as to what you then do about it. That's another matter. There is research by Pia Honnold at the time, that was her name, who did studies of how people in China and people in Germany learn about mobile phone usage, and they did do the studies and then have much better strategies for what documentation or online help would be like to be helpful to the people, because there needed to be different strategies. What works in Northern Europe is not necessarily going to work in parts of China and vice versa. So there's a lot to learn and a lot to apply, even by studies that have already taken place in some related fields.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I think that we're now at the stage where we're going to open to discussion. I have a hand here, please. Could you please tell us your name and where you're coming from?
Should they go to the microphone? Or?
Yes, please. Over there.
That was a good music.
Oh, there. That's a good rebellion.
I'm Daniel Benner, and I run what I call a vocational network. It's a collaboration of filmmakers, and we're operating it in both English and Spanish now. The problem that I've encountered is that one of my partners is from Mexico City, so you know we have the full capability to publish in Spanish and receive questions and answer them in Spanish. However, we're struggling a little bit with, is it more the case that the people that we're trying to get interested in collaborating are not as used to the social media perspectives, or is there really a cultural gap that we're not able to address? And then, how do we go about addressing that?
Thank you. Are you addressing that question to anybody in particular?
No.
Well, there have been studies done with trying to get response in focus groups and other things that have tested India. I don't know about Mexico and the U.S., but I know India and other countries where they've had to change dramatically how you ask questions, how you get people involved. And if you find the right techniques, ba-boom, things change dramatically. They couldn't get any response out of people, and then when they decided to create user scenarios that were modeled on Bollywood movies, and they could get involved with the emotions of key characters like people do in India with the Bollywood films, then all of a sudden people were very articulate, they were very responsive, they had a lot to say, they leaped right in, and the whole thing was incredibly successful by grabbing hold of emotions and passions in a way that are excluded in many typical Western situations. That's just the hint of a start.
Please, would you use that microphone or mine if you prefer? And tell us who you are. And by the way, meantime, I'm sorry, the volunteers will be passing around some feedback cards, so please do fill them up because they're important for next year's organization. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Fazia Rizvi. I'm a graduate student of anthropology at Texas State University down in San Marcos. And one of the things I'm interested in is emerging cultures in the cyber world. Was wondering, recently IBM decided to hire a lot of anthropologists to pair an anthropologist with each of their software development groups in order to kind of address these issues of how their software products would be used in other cultural contexts, particularly in China and that sort of thing. Are game developers doing the same sort of thing? Have they considered reaching out to anthropology and pairing up with people who do these sorts of cultural studies when they do the development of games?
I'm not aware of any major company doing that. I think that it's a major hole in the industry. I think that, as I commented earlier, I think there's a lot of blinkered design going on. People have a cool idea for a game design, and they know it will play in one territory. Often it will be designed to play first and foremost in North America. Now let's And even the concept that you create a game in one language aimed at one culture, and then you talk about, well, the fact that we have the whole idea of then translating it for other cultures rather than building it from the ground up so that it would actually work on a multicultural basis, definitely see that as part of what the next wave of game design needs to be. And it's one of the reasons I'm excited about this sort of worldwide international social game playing, because you can't ignore those questions going forward. The World of Warcraft was just a very mild example of the problems we're going to hit if people ignore cultural factors in game design going forward. Yeah.
Thank you, Tim. Please.
Have you seen any examples of companies that have adapted their website to include be more inclusive of another culture and then had rushback from the initial group that they were targeted at? You know, companies that adapted a more an international look, and then you get how come you don't like America or whatever type of response?
The classic story, and someone may have a more current one that's more specifically to your question, but the classic story that I like was Orkut, of course, like all these things. Orkut was a social network that came out of Google, rolled out with a primarily North American audience, and then for some interesting reasons we can talk about if there's more time, was widely adopted in Brazil. And Brazilians soon were the number one users in Orkut. And the place filled up with Portuguese. And the American users went nuts. What in the hell are all you foreigners doing speaking a foreign language on our World Wide Web? So that's happened at least in one classic scenario. Maybe people know of something more recent.
Anybody else on this?
I'm trying to think of good success stories to mention, but I can't think of any quite yet.
But we have more people.
Hi. Are there any sort of roadmaps that exist out there right now to sort of navigate the world's different cultures, or do they change too often to really sort of write down what's important and what's not important to the different people and places of the world?
Who wants to answer?
Would you like to hear from anti-cultural model or pro-cultural model?
Yeah, go buy Hofstede's book. What I would love to know is whether anybody's taken that and turned it into specifically, website design, five cultural dimensions thing. I mean, I probably would hate it, but I'd love to read it.
We're proposing such things constantly, and we've done some of that work of trying to take to develop culture-oriented website design guidelines. And we certainly have studied Hofstede a lot, but I don't mean to base all of our work, in fact, on that model. That's why we studied 11 others or 10 others and created a composite set. In fact, if you look at the papers that appear in conferences like IWIPS, IWIPS, the International Workshop for the Internationalization of Products and Services. I'm sorry for the long name. It's held in a different country every year. You will see many people using not just one model, but actually dimensions from a number of models, doing a composite set that seems to work for them. And there are explanations of these cultures published by Hofstede and about half a dozen other key theorists in the industry. Certainly, I'll include those in the bibliography set. And many papers that do try to give some guidelines, especially for particular areas of development like banking websites. You know, if your content is narrower, you can see more easily how to translate some of these differences into specifics of appearance, structure, hierarchy, etc. I'm reminded of another anecdote. Sorry to take up your time. I was flying once from Mexico City to Cairo. And sitting next to me was a guy from Procter & Gamble, and I started to talk. He said he was going to a major sales meeting in Cairo of all the salespeople from Europe and the Middle East. And I said, oh, you know, when you get together, do you guys talk about what works in one country and culture and doesn't in another, and are there patterns? And he laughed at me and said, of course we talk about that. Our company is more than 100 years old. We have a lot of data, a lot of insight on what works in certain villages, even by village type, based on climate and geographical as well as culture differences. And I said, oh, that is so exciting. Would you be willing to come to our conferences in computer technology? Because we're just starting to learn about all that stuff, and that would be so helpful. And he laughed at me again and said, of course I'm not going to do that. What are you, an idiot? That's the basis of some of our marketing success. So really, get serious. The people in cereals and soap suds have been doing this for a long time. Coca-Cola changes its mixture to suit the Middle East, Northern Europe, the U.S., etc. Why would you think that our games, our websites, our social networks wouldn't respond and somehow be more usable, useful, and appealing based on these local characteristics?
Can we have another question, please?
Yeah, hi. I'd like to direct this to Marcus. I'm developing a social networking site and online collaboration platform focused on environmentalism.
Focused on what?
Focused on environmentalism. My question is, we're trying to maintain a global focus, and in order to maximize cross-cultural participation, could you offer up any advice on how to best achieve that?
That was addressed to me. On how to give information more successfully?
On how to maximize collaboration across multiple cultures from around the world.
Can you try to be pretty quick on your answer, because we really have 2 minutes and we have two people still.
I'm hire some people who have a lot of knowledge in this area.
Good answer.
I'll be happy to talk with you later.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
You talked a bit earlier, Steve, about the, you know, it's very easy to forget about infrastructure. And to work at the highest possible level with your when you're designing a product. How do you think you can break down that highest standard that a lot of developers work to of trying to say, well, how do we push the technology? And how do you think you can break that culture down to say, well, how do we get to the broadest acceptable technology?
A lot of it gets back to market dynamics. When you look at the companies that have the resources and the talent that it takes to create these innovative devices, but to do so in a cost-effective manner, you have to show them that there's a market for that technology. And what we try to do when we work with partners throughout the world is ensure that they see that there is a business model and a return on that investment by going to those markets. So it's a dual thing. Number one is you're showing up with a product that is well-built, it's a quality product, and it can be used by the local population. But number two, because you design it in a way that it's affordable and you're putting in that model in place that comes with the microfinancing and ensures that local content is available so that once they're online, they can actually see something in their own language that applies to their daily lives. By taking that ecosystem approach, then you're giving them something that truly is usable. Because no matter where people are in the world, if they're going to spend their hard-earned money, they want something quality in return for it. And if you show up with something that may work here that has no application or hasn't quite taken the ecosystem in consideration, then it's destined to fail and you're going to end up with a very dissatisfied consumer.
Well, thank you so much. I think it's time for us to wrap up. I really want to thank you all and our panelists. This has been a great experience. Thank you so much. And I was going to ask, Steve, you could set up the EXO laptop.
Of course.
If people are curious. Okay. And I think, Aaron, you'll be available for this gentleman who asked you about the portal. Okay. So we'll be available for questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you.